Chapter 2. A reluctant dawn, a dim, blood-red sun. And although the sea was diminishing fast, it was still wilder than most sailors had ever seen, with bursting waves and a still prodigious swell. A desolate ocean, grey now, under a deathly white, rolling with enormous force, but still with no life upon it apart from these two ships, now dismasted and tossing like paper boats on a millstream. They were at some distance from one another, both apparently wrecks, floating but out of control. Beyond them, to windward, a newly arisen island of black rock and cinders. It no longer shot out fire, but every now and then, with an enormous shriek, a vast jet of steam leapt from the crater, mingled with ash and volcanic gases. When Jack first saw the island, it was 180 feet high, but the rollers had already swept away great quantities of the clinker, and by the time the sun was clear of the murk, not 50 feet remained. The more northern of the ships, the Surprise, was in fact quite well in hand, lying to under a storm trysail on her only undamaged lower mast, while her people did all that very weary men could do, it had been all hands all night, to repair her damaged main top and to cross at least the lower yard. They had the strongest motives for doing so, since their quarry, totally dismasted, and wallowing gunwales under on the swell, lay directly under their lee. But there was no certainty that, helpless though she seemed, she might not send up some kind of a jury rig and slip away into the thick weather with its promise of blinding squalls.
"Lobelins bows!"
cried Captain Aubrey, watching the spare topmast with anxious care.
"Bows away! Belay!"
And to his first lieutenant,
"Oh, Tom, how I hope the doctor comes on deck before the land vanishes."
Tom Pullings shook his head. "When last I saw him, perhaps an hour ago, he could hardly stand for sleep. Blood up to the elbows, and blood where he had wiped his eyes."
"It would be the world's pity, was he to miss all this," said Jack.
He was no naturalist, but from first light he had been very deeply impressed, not only by this mineral landscape, but also by the universal death all round as far as eye could see. Countless fish of every kind, most wholly unknown to him, lay dead upon their sides. A sperm whale, not quite grey, floated among them. Abyssal forms, huge squids trailing half the length of the ship, and never a bird, never a single gull. A sulphurous whiff from the island half choked him.
"He will never forgive me if I do not tell him," he said. "Do you suppose he has turned in?"
"Good morning, gentlemen," said Stephen from the companion ladder. "What is this I hear about an island?"
He was looking incredibly frowsy, unwashed, unshaved, no wig, old bloody shirt, bloody apron still round his waist, and it was clear that even he felt it improper to advance to the holy place itself.
"Let me steady you,"
said Jack, stepping across the heaving deck. Stephen had dipped his hands, but not his arms, and they looked like pale gloves against the red-brown. Jack seized one, hauled him up, and led him to the rail.
"There is the island," he said. "But tell me, how is West? And are any of the others dangerously hurt?"
"West? There is no change, and I can do nothing until I have more light and a steadier basis. As for the others, there is always the possibility of sepsis and mortification, but with the blessing I think they will come through. So that is your island. And God help us, look at the sea! A rolling, heaving graveyard. Jesus, Mary and Joseph. Whales. 8 species of shark. Scombridae, cephalopods, and all parboiled. This is exactly what Dr. Falconer of the Daisy told us about. Submarine eruption, immense turbulence, the appearance of an island of rock or cinders, a cone shooting out flames, mephitic vapours, volcanic bombs, and scoriae. And I never grasped what was happening. Yet there I had the typical lacerated wounds sometimes accompanied by scorching, and the evidence of heavy globular objects striking sails, deck, masts, and of course poor West. You knew what was afoot, I'm sure."
"Not until we began knotting and splicing at first light," said Jack. "And when they brought me some of your bombs, there is one by the capstan must weigh 50 pound, and showed me the cinders the rain had not washed away. Then I saw the whole thing plain. I think I should have smoked it earlier if the island had blazed away good and steady like Stromboli, but it kept shooting out jets, quite like a battery of mortars. But at least I was not so foolishly mistaken about the Franklin. There she lies, right under our lee. You will have to stand on the carronade slide to see her. Take my glass."
The Franklin was of infinitely less interest to Dr. Maturin than the encyclopedia of marine life heaving on the swell below. But he climbed up, gazed, and said, "She is in the sad way altogether with no masts at all. How she rolls! Do you suppose we shall be able to catch her? Our sails seem somewhat out of order."
"Perhaps we shall," said Jack. "We should have steerage way in about 5 minutes, but there is no hurry. She has few hands on deck, and those few cannot be called very brisk. I'd much rather bear down fully prepared, so that there can be no argument, no foolish waste of life, let alone spars and cordage."
Six bells, and Stephen said, "I must go below." Jack gave him a hand as far as the ladder, and having urged him
to clap on for dear life,
asked whether they should meet for breakfast, adding that this unnatural hellfire sea would go down as suddenly as it had got up.
"A late breakfast? I hope so indeed," said Stephen, making his way down by single steps and moving, as Jack noticed for the first time, like an old man.
It was after this late breakfast that Stephen, somewhat restored and by now reconciled to the fact that the dead marine animals were too far altered by heat, battering and sometimes by great change of depth to be valued as specimens, sat under an awning watching the Franklin grow larger. For the rest, he and Martin contented themselves with counting at least the main genera and rehearsing all that Dr. Falconer had said about submarine volcanic activity, so usual in these parts. They had little energy for more. The wind had dropped, and a squall having cleared the air of volcanic dust, the sun beat down on the heaving sea with more than ordinary strength. The Surprise, under forecourse and main topsail, bore slowly down on the privateer, rarely exceeding 3 knots. Her guns were loaded and run out. Her boarders had their weapons at hand, but their earlier apprehensions had died away entirely. The chase had suffered much more than they had. She was much less well equipped with stores and seamen, and she made no attempt to escape. It had to be admitted that with scarcely 3 foot of her main and mizzen masts showing above deck, and the foremast gone at the partners, her condition was almost desperate. But she could surely have done something with the wreckage over the side, still hanging by the shrouds and stays, something with the spars still to be seen in her waist, something with her undamaged bowsprit. The Surprises looked at her with a certain tolerant contempt. With the monstrous seas fast declining, the galley fires had been lit quite early, and this being Thursday, they had all eaten a pound of reasonably fresh pork, half a pint of dried peas, some of the remaining Wahoo yams, and as a particular indulgence, a large quantity of plum duff. They had also drunk a quarter of a pint of Sydney rum, publicly diluted with 3/4 of a pint of water and lemon juice, and now, with full bellies and benevolent minds, they felt that the natural order of things was returning. The barkie, though cruelly mauled, was in a fair way to being shipshape, and they were bearing down upon their prey. Closer and closer, until the capricious breeze headed them and Jack steered south and west to run alongside the Franklin on the following tack. But as the Surprise was seen to change course, a confused bawling arose from the Franklin, and a kind of raft was launched over her side, paddled by a single man with a bloody bandage round his head. Jack let fly the sheets, checking the frigate's way, and the man, heaved closer by the swell, called,
"Pray can you give me some water for our wounded men? They are dying of thirst."
"Do you surrender?"
The man half raised himself to reply. He was clearly no seaman, and cried,
"How can you speak so at such a time, sir? Shame on you!"
His voice was harsh, high-pitched, and furiously indignant. Jack's expression did not change, but after a pause in which the raft drifted nearer, he hailed the boatswain on the forecastle.
"Mr. Bulkley there, let the doctor's skiff be lowered down with a couple of breakers in it."
"If you have a surgeon aboard, it would be a Christian act in him to relieve their pain,"
said the man on the raft, now closer still.
"By God,"
began Jack, and there were exclamations all along the gangway. But as Stephen and Martin had already gone below for their instruments, Jack said no more than,
"Bondon, place, pull them over, and you had better pass that raft a line. Mr. Reed, take possession."
Ever since this chase began, Stephen had been considering his best line of conduct in the event of its success. His would have been a delicate mission in any event, since it presupposed activities contrary to Spanish interests in South America at a time when Spain was at least nominally an ally of the United Kingdom. But now that the British government had been compelled to deny the existence of any such undertaking, it was more delicate by far, and he was extremely unwilling to be recognised by Dutourd, whom he had met in Paris. Not that Dutourd was a Bonapartist or in any way connected with French intelligence, but he had an immense acquaintance and he was incurably talkative, far too talkative for any intelligence service to consider making use of him. Dutourd was the man on the raft, the owner of the Franklin, and the sequence of events that had brought about their curious proximity, separated by no more than 20 feet of tow-line, was this. Dutourd, a man of passionate enthusiasms, had, like many others at the time, fallen in love with the idea of a terrestrial paradise to be founded in a perfect climate, where there should be perfect equality as well as justice, and plenty without excessive labour, trade, or the use of money. A true democracy, a more cheerful Sparta. And unlike most others, he was rich enough to carry his theories into something like practice, acquiring this American-built privateer, manning her with prospective settlers and a certain number of seamen, most of the people being French-Canadians or men from Louisiana, and sailing her to Oahu, an island well south of Hawaii, where, with the help of a northern chief and his own powers of persuasion, he hoped to found his colony. But the northern chief had misused some British ships and seamen, and the surprise, sent to deal with the situation, destroyed him in a short, horrible battle immediately before the Franklin sailed in from a cruise, a private ship of war wearing American colours. The chase had begun in what seemed another world. Now it was ending. As the crowded boat rose and fell, traversing the last quarter of a mile, Stephen derived some comfort from the fact that during his earlier years in Paris, he had used the second half of his name, Maturin Idomanova. Maturin, spelt with an H, M-A-T-H-U-R-I-N, but pronounced without it, having ludicrous associations with idiocy in the jargon of that time. And from the reflection that it was much easier to feign stupidity than wisdom, although it might be a mistake to know no French at all, he did not have to speak it very well.
"Bring the raft against the chains," called Reed.
"Against the chains it is, sir," replied Bondon.
And looking over his shoulder, he pulled hard ahead, judging the swell just so. The raft lurched against the Franklin's side, and she was so low in the water that it was no great step for Dutourd to go aboard directly. Two more heaves, and Bondon hooked on. Dutourd helped Stephen over the shattered gunwale with one hand, while with the other he swept off his hat, saying,
"I am deeply sensible of your goodness in coming, sir."
Stephen instantly saw that his anxiety had been quite needless. There was no hint of recognition in the earnest look that accompanied these words. Of course, a public man like Dutourd, perpetually addressing assemblies, meeting scores, even hundreds of people a day, would not remember a slight acquaintance of several years ago. 3 or 4 meetings in Madame Roland's salon before the war, at a time when his republican principles had already caused him to change his name from Dutourd to Dutourd, and then 2 or 3 dinners during the short-lived peace. Yet himself he would have known Dutourd, a curiously striking man, more full of life than most, giving the impression of being physically larger than he was, in fact. An animated face, an easy, rapid flow of speech, upright, head held high. These thoughts presented themselves to his mind while at the same time he registered the desolation fore and aft, the tangle of sailcloth, cordage and shattered spars, the demoralization of the hands. Some few were still mechanically pumping, but most were either drunk or reduced to a hopeless apathy. Martin, Reed, and Place boarded the Franklin on 3 successive swells, Bondon fending off, and in a high, clear voice, Reed, taking off his hat, said,
"Monsieur, je prends le commandement de ce vaisseau."
"Bien, monsieur," said Dutourd.
Reed stepped to the stump of the mainmast. Place lashed a stray stunsail boom to it, and amid the heavy indifference of the Franklin's crew, they hoisted British colours. There was a modest cheer from the surprise. Dutourd said,
"Gentlemen, most of the wounded are in the cabin. May I lead the way?"
As they went down the ladder, they heard Reed call to Bondon, who had an extremely powerful voice, telling him to hail the ship and ask for the boatswain, his mate, Perdine, and all the hands who could be spared. The prize was near foundering. On the starboard side of the cabin a dozen men lay side by side, and another was stretched out motionless on the stern window locker. In this heat they were suffering terribly from thirst. but the ship had such a heel to larboard that on the other side there was a wretched tangle of living and dead washing about with every roll. Screams, groaning, a shocking stench, and cries for help, cries for rescue.
"Come, sir, take off your coat," said Stephen.
Dutour obeyed, and the three of them pulled and lifted with what care they could. The dead they dragged to the half-deck. The living they laid in something like an order of urgency.
"Can you command your men?" asked Stephen.
"Some few, I think," said Dutour. "But most of them are drunk."
"Then tell them to throw the dead overboard and to bring buckets and swabs to clean where the dead men lay."
He called to Bonden out of the shattered stern window.
"Barrett Bonden, now, can you heave up the little keg till Mr. Martin and I can catch a hold on it?"
"I'll try, sir," said Bonden.
"We shall have to move this man," said Stephen,
nodding at the figure lying on the locker.
"In any case, he is dead."
"He was my sailing master," said Dutour. "Your last shot killed him, his mate, and most of the crew. The other gun burst."
Stephen nodded. He had seen a raking shot do terrible damage, and as for a bursting gun...
"Shall we ease him out of the window? I must look to these men at once."
"Very well," said Dutour.
And as the rigid corpse slid into the sea, so Bonden called,
"On the rise, sir! Clap on!"
And the keg came aboard. Martin started the bung with a serving mallet. He had only a filthy can to serve it out, but in this unnatural parching heat, neither filth nor can was of the least account, only the infinitely precious water.
"Now, sir," said Stephen to Dutour, "a pint is all or you will bloat. Sit here and show me your head."
Beneath the handkerchief, dried blood and matted hair, there was a razor-like cut along the side of his scalp, certainly a piece of flying metal. Stephen clipped, sponged, and sewed. No reaction as the needle went in. Clapped a bandage over all and said,
"That should answer for the moment. Pray go on deck and set your men to pumping more briskly. They may have the other breaker."
Stephen was thoroughly accustomed to the consequences of a battle at sea, and Martin moderately so, but here the usual gunshot and splinter wounds and the frightful effects of a bursting gun were accompanied by the unfamiliar wounds caused by volcanic eruption, worse lacerations than they had seen in the surprise, and, since the Franklin had been closer to the vent, much more severe burning. They were both dog-tired, short of supplies, short of strength, and of breath in the stifling heat of the cabin, and it was with relief that they saw Padine arrive with lint, tow, bandages, splints, all that an intelligent man could think of, and heard Mr. Bulkley wind his call, ordering the Franklins to the pumps. They might not have understood the boatswain's French, but there was no mistaking his rope's end, his pointing finger, and his terrible voice. Jack had sent Awkward Davies over with Padine, as well as the boatswain and all the expert hands he could spare. Davies was biddable with Stephen, and with these two very powerful men to lift, hold, and restrain, the medicos dealt with their patients each in turn. They were taking a leg off at the hip when Reed came below. Averting his ashy face, he said,
"Sir, I'm to carry the Franklin's master back to the ship with his papers. Have you any message?"
"None, thank you, Mr. Reed. Padine, clap on now."
"Before I go, sir, shall I get the boatswain to unship the companion?"
Stephen did not hear him through the patient's long, quavering scream. But a moment later the whole framework overhead was lifted off, and the fetid room was filled with brilliant light and clean, almost cool sea air. From the first, Jack Aubrey had disliked all that he had heard of Dutour. Stephen described him as a good, benevolent man who had been misled first by
that mumping villain Rousseau,
and later by his passionate belief in his own system, based, it was true, on a hatred of poverty, war, and injustice, but also on the assumption that men were naturally and equally good, needing only a firm, friendly hand to set them on the right path, the path to the realization of their full potentialities. This, of course, entailed the abolition of the present order, which had so perverted them, and of the established churches. It was old, old stuff, familiar in all its variations, but Stephen had never heard it expressed with such freshness, fire, and conviction. Neither fire nor conviction survived to reach Jack in Stephen's summary, however, but the doctrine that levelled Nelson with one of his own bargemen was clear enough, and he watched the approaching boat with a cold look in his eye. The coldness grew to strong disapproval when Dutour, coming aboard in the traditional manner with the sidemen offering him hand ropes, failed to salute the quarterdeck. He had also failed to put on a sword to make his formal surrender. Jack at once retired to his cabin, saying to Pullings,
"Tom, pray bring that man below, with his papers."
He received Dutour sitting, but he did not tell Killick to place a chair for the gentleman, while to Dutour himself he said,
"I believe, sir, that you speak English fluently."
"Moderately so, sir, and may I use what fluency I possess to thank you for your humanity to my people. Your surgeon and his assistant have exerted themselves nobly."
"You are very good, sir,"
said Jack, with a civil inclination of his head. And after an inquiry about Dutour's wound, he said,
"I take it that you are not a seaman by profession, that you are not very well acquainted with the customs of the sea?"
"Scarcely at all, sir. I have managed a pleasure boat, but for the open sea I have always engaged a sailing master. I cannot describe myself as a seaman. I have spent very little time on the sea."
"That alters the case somewhat,"
thought Jack, and he said,
"Please to show me your papers."
Dutour's most recent sailing master had been an exact and orderly person, as well as a taut skipper and an excellent seaman, and Dutour handed over a complete set wrapped in waxed sailcloth. Jack looked through them with satisfaction, then frowned and looked through the parcels again.
"But where is your commission or letter of mark?"
"I have no commission or letter of mark, sir,"
replied Dutour, shaking his head and smiling a little.
"I am only a private citizen, not a naval officer. My sole purpose was to found a colony for the benefit of mankind."
"No commission? Either American or French?"
"No, no. It never occurred to me to solicit one. Is it looked upon as a necessary formality?"
"Very much so."
"I remember having received a letter from the Minister of Marine, wishing me every happiness on my voyage. Perhaps that would answer?"
"I am afraid not, sir. Your happiness has included the taking of several prizes I collect."
"Why, yes, sir. You will not think me impertinent if I observe that our countries, alas, are in a state of war."
"So I understand. But wars are conducted according to certain forms. They are not wild riots in which anyone may join and seize whatever he can overpower. And I fear that if you can produce nothing better than the recollection of a letter wishing you every happiness, you must be hanged as a pirate."
"I am concerned to hear it. But as for prizes, as for the merely privateering aspects of the voyage, Mr. Chauncey, my sailing master, has a paper from his government. We sailed under American colours, you will recall. It is in a cover marked Mr. Chauncey's Qualifications and References in my writing desk."
"You did not bring it?"
"No, sir. The young gentleman with one arm told me there was not a moment to be lost, so I abandoned all my personal property."
"I shall send for it. Pray describe the writing desk."
"An ordinary brass-bound walnut tree writing desk with my name on the plate. But there can be very little hope of finding it now."
"Why do you say that?"
"My dear sir, I have seen sailors at work aboard a captured ship."
Jack made no reply, but glancing through the scuttle, he saw that Bulkley and his men had now raised a spar on the stump of her mizzenmast, and that with an improvised lugsail she was lying with her head to the sea, lying much easier. The Surprise would be alongside in a few minutes.
"Have you any officer surviving unhurt?"
he asked.
"None, sir. They were both killed."
"A servant?"
"Yes, sir. He hid below with the ransomers."
"Killick, Killick there! Pass the word for Captain Pullings."
"Aye, aye, sir, Captain Pullings it is,"
replied Killick, who could give a civil answer when guests or prisoners of rank were present. But instead of Pullings, there appeared young Norton, who said,
"I beg pardon, sir, but Captain Pullings and Mr. Granger at the masthead getting the top over. May I carry them a message?"
"Are they got so far so soon? Upon my word! Never worry them at such a delicate point, Mr. Norton. Jump up on deck yourself, borrow a speaking trumpet, and hail the Franklin. Tell Bondon and Place to have Mr. Dutour's servant, sea-chest, and writing-desk ready to be brought across as soon as there is a moment to spare. But first take this gentleman into the gun-room and tell the steward to bring him whatever he calls for. I'm going into the foretop."
"Aye, aye, sir. Mr. Dutour's servant, sea-chest, and writing-desk as soon as there is a moment, and Mr. Dutour to the gun-room."
Dutour opened his mouth to speak, but it was too late. Jack, throwing off his coat, sped from the cabin, making the deck tremble as he went. And Norton said,
"This way, sir, if you please."
And some minutes later, the message reached Bondon's ear, as he and his mates were hauling an uninjured topmast aboard by its shrouds. He in turn hailed the boatswain.
"Mr. Bulkley there!
I must take Mr. Dutour's servant, chest and writing desk across. May I have the skiff?
Yes, mate, replied the boatswain, his mouth filled with rope yarns. Unless you'd sooner walk, and bring me back a pair of girt lines and two long tackle blocks, and the coil of 1.5-inch manila above the fore hatchway.
Jack returned to the cabin with the liveliest satisfaction. In spite of the absence of Mr. Bulkley and many very able seamen, the surprise had made an extraordinary recovery. It was true that she had at least half a dozen forecastlemen who, apart from the paperwork, could have served with credit as boatswain in a man of war, and it was true that as Jack was wealthy, she was uncommonly well supplied with stores. Yet even so, the change from the chaos of first light to the present approach to trim efficiency was very striking. At this rate, the frigate, with 4 new pairs of preventer stays set up in the morning, would be able to carry on under topsails and courses tomorrow, for the trades were already steadying over a more nearly normal sea.
"Pass the word for Mr. Dutour," he called.
"Which his name is really Turd,"
observed Killick to his mate Grimshaw, before making his way to the gunroom to wake the red-eyed Frenchman.
"There you are, sir,"
said Jack as he was led into the cabin.
"Here is your sea-chest, and here is what appears to be your writing-desk,"
pointing to a box whose brass plate, already automatically polished by Killick, bore the name Jean Dutour, clean and plain.
"I am amazed," cried Dutour. "I never thought to see them again."
"I hope you will be able to find the cover you spoke of."
"I am sure I shall. The desk is still locked," said Dutour, feeling for his keys.
"Ask pardon, sir," said Mr. Adams, Jack's highly valued clerk, "but it wants less than a minute to the hour."
"Forgive me, monsieur," said Jack, leaping from his seat. "I shall be back in a few moments. Pray search for your paper."
He and Adams had been carrying out a chain of observations, always made at stated intervals, wind direction and strength, estimated current, barometrical pressure, compass variations, humidity, temperature of the air, both wet bulb and dry, and of the sea at given depths, together with the salinity at those depths, and the blueness of the sky, a series that was to be carried round the world and communicated to Humboldt on the one hand, and the Royal Society on the other. It would be a great pity to break its exact sequence at such a very interesting point. A long pause. Nautical cries. The click, click, click of capstan paws as a great spar rose up, and almost immediately after the cry of "Belay!" Captain Aubrey returned.
"I have found the certificate," said Dutour,
starting up from his half-doze and handing him a paper.
"I rejoice to hear it," said Jack.
He sat down at his desk, but having read the letter attentively, he frowned and said,
"Yes, this is very well, and it allows Mr. William B. Chauncey, who was, I presume, your sailing master, to take, burn, sink, or destroy ships or vessels belonging to His Britannic Majesty or sailing under British colours, but it makes no mention of Mr. Dutour, no mention at all."
Dutour said nothing. He was yellow-pale by now. He put his hand to his bandaged head, and Jack had the impression that he no longer cared whether he was to be hanged as a pirate or not, so long as he was allowed to lie down in peace for a while. Jack considered for some moments and then said,
"Well, sir, I must say you are an anomalous kind of prisoner, rather like the creature that was neither flesh nor fowl nor good red herring, but partook of each, the Sphinx. You are a sort of owner, a sort of commander, though absent from the master role, and a sort of what I can only call a pirate. I'm not at all sure what I ought to do with you. As you have no commission, I cannot treat you as an officer. You cannot berth aft."
Another pause, during which Dutour closed his eyes.
"But fortunately the Surprise is a roomy ship with a small company, and right forward on the lower deck we have made cabins for the gunner, the boatswain, and the carpenter. There are still 2 to spare, and you shall have one of them. Since you have no surviving officers, you will have to mess by yourself, but I dare say the gunroom will invite you quite often, and of course you may have the liberty of the quarter-deck."
Dutour made no acknowledgment of this offer. His head drooped, and the next roll pitched him right out of his seat, head first. Jack picked him up, laid him on the cushioned stern lock, and called for Killick.
"What are you thinking of, sir?" cried his steward. "Don't you see he is bleeding like a pig from under his bandage?"
Killick whipped into the quarter-gallery for a towel and thrust it under Dutour's head.
"Now I must take all them covers off and soak them this directly minute in cold fresh water, and there ain't no cold fresh water which the scuttlebutt is empty till Chips comes back and shifts the hand-pump."
"Never you mind the bloody covers," said Jack,
suddenly so angry with extreme weariness that it cowed even Killick.
"You and Grimshaw jump forward to the cabin next to the bosun's, get a bed from Mr. Adams, sling a hammock and lay him in it, and have his sea chest lighted along. Do you hear me there?"
Extreme weariness. It pervaded both ships, evening out the gloom of the defeated and the elation of the conquerors. Both sets of men would have resigned prize money or freedom to be allowed to go below and take their ease. But it was not to be. The few able-bodied prisoners had to pump steadily to keep their ship clear, or haul on a rope at the word of command. And in both ships it was all hands on deck until enough canvas could be spread to allow them at least to lie to in something like safety if it came on to blow. And the glass was far from steady, and neither the midday nor the present evening sky was at all certain. The only apparently idle hands in either ship were the medical men. They had returned to the frigate some time before. They had made the rounds of the sick berth and its extensions, and now they were waiting for a pause in the general activity, when someone would have time to pull Martin, who was to spend the night in the Franklin, across the lane of choppy water that separated the ships. Although both medicos could row, after a fashion, neither could afford to have inept, clumsy fingers with so strong a likelihood of further surgery. They were watching the extraction of the Franklin's broken lower masts and their replacement by a jury rig, and from time to time Stephen explained the various operations.
"There, do you see?" he said. "Those two very long legs joining at the top with a pair of stout pulleys at the juncture, and their feet resting on planks either side of the deck, are the shears I was speaking about. See the men haul them upright by a rope, perhaps even a hawser, running through yet another pulley, or block, as I should say, to the capstan, while at the same time any undue motion is restrained by the... Mr. Reed, what is the name of those ropes fore and aft and sideways?"
"Guys, sir. And those at the bottom of the shears are tail tackles."
"Thank you, my dear. Let me advise you not to run in that impetuous manner, however."
"Oh, sir, if I did not run in this impetuous manner—"
"Mr. Reed, there! Have you gone to sleep again?"
called Pullings, very hoarse, very savage.
"Now, as you see, Martin, the shears are quite upright. They let down the lower pulley. The bosun attaches it to the broken mast by a certain knot. He bids them heave, or haul. He encourages them with cries, with blows. Those must be the idle prisoners. The stump rises, it is detached, cast off. They bring the new spar. I believe it is one of our spare topmasts. They make it fast. Up it rises, up and up, and up, until it dangles over the very hole, the partners, as the mariner calls it, and yet, with the motion of the ship, how it wanders. Mr. Bulkley seizes it, he cries out, they lower away, and the mast descends. It is firm, pinned, no doubt, and wedged. Someone, it is surely Barrett Bondon, is hoisted to the trestle trees to place the rigging over the upper end in due order."
"If you please, sir," said Emily, "Perdine says may Willis have his slime draught now."
"He may have it at the third stroke of the bell," said Stephen.
She ran off, her slim black form weaving unnoticed through gangs of seamen intent upon a great variety of tasks, too weary to be jocular. And Stephen said,
"If one, then all, and we have mere chaos."
He had often said this before, and Martin only nodded. They watched in silence as the shears moved forward to the stump of the Franklin's mainmast, fitting to it a curious object made up of yet another spare topmast and a handmast, the two coupled athwartships by two lower caps and a double upper cap above the refashioned maintop. Stephen did not attempt to explain the course of this particular operation, which he had never seen before. Until now, neither had spoken of West's death, apart from their brief exchange in the sick berth. But during a short pause in the hammering behind them and the repeated shouts from the Franklin, Stephen said,
"I am of opinion that there was such damage to the brain that an even earlier, more skilful intervention would have made no difference."
"I am certain of it," said Martin.
"I wish I were," thought Stephen. "Yet then again, what is gratifying to self-love is not necessarily untrue."
The arduous fitting of the double cap went on and on. They watched in stupid, heavy-headed incomprehension.
"Such news, sir!" cried Reed, flitting by. "The captain is going to set up a lateen on her mizzen. What a sight that will be!
It'll not be long now."
The sun was nearly touching the horizon, and both over the water and in the surprise, the people could be seen coiling down and clearing away. The carpenters were collecting their tools. Stephen, sunk in melancholy thought, recalled his motions with that singular clarity which comes with certain degrees of tiredness and in some dreams. He could feel the vibration of his trephine cutting through the injured skull, an operation he had carried out many, many times without failure. The raising of the disc of bone, the flow of extravasated blood. They were both far away in their reflections, and Stephen had almost forgotten that he was not alone when Martin, his eyes fixed on the prize, said,
"You understand these things better than I do, for sure. Pray, which do you think the better purchase for a man in my position and with my responsibilities? The Navy Fives or South Sea Stock?"
Stephen was called out only twice that night, and his third sleep was of the most delicious kind, changing, evolving, from something not unlike coma to a consciousness of total relaxation, of mental recovery and physical comfort. And so he lay, blinking in the early light and musing on a wide variety of pleasant things. Diana's kindness to him when he was ill in Sweden, goshawks he had known, a Boccherini cello sonata, whales. But a steady, familiar, discordant noise pierced through this amiable wandering. Several times he dismissed his identification as absurd. He had known the Navy for many years, he was acquainted with its excesses, but this was too wild entirely. Yet at last the combination of sounds, grinding, scrubbing, bucket clashing, water streaming, swabs driving the tide into the scuppers, bare feet padding and hoarse whispers just over his head could no longer be denied. The larboard watch and the idlers were cleaning the deck, getting all the volcanic dust and cinders from under gratings, gun carriages, and such unlikely places as the binnacle drawers. Yet as his conscious mind accepted this, so yesterday came flooding back, and the extravagance of the sailor's activity disappeared. Mr. West had died. He was to be buried at sea in the forenoon watch, and they were seeing to it that he should go over the side from a ship in tolerably good order. He was not an outstandingly popular officer, nor was he very clever either, and sometimes he did tend to top it the knob, being more quarter-deck than tarpaulin. But he was not in the least ill-natured, never had a man brought up before the captain as a defaulter, and there was no question at all of his courage. He had distinguished himself when the surprise cut the Diane out at St. Martin's, while in this last affair at Moahu he had done everything a good, active officer could do. But above all, they were used to him. They had sailed with him for a great while now. They liked what they were used to, and they knew what was due to a shipmate. If there had been any danger of Stephen's forgetting, then the appearance of the deck when he came up into the sparkling open air and the brilliant light after his long morning round would have brought it all to mind. Quite apart from the fact that the waist of the ship, the part between the quarter-deck and the forecastle, where ordinarily he saw a mass of spare masts, yards and spars, in general covered with tarpaulins on the booms, the boats nestling among them, was now quite clear, the spars nearly all used and the boats either busy or towing astern, which gave her a singular, clean-run austerity. Quite apart from this, there had been an extraordinary change from the apparent confusion and real filth of yesterday to a Sunday neatness, falls flemished, brass flaming in the sun, yards as there were, exactly squared by the lifts and braces. But there was an even greater change in the atmosphere, a formality and gravity shown at one end of the scale by Sarah and Emily, who had finished their duties in the sick berth half an hour before, and who were now standing on the forecastle in their best pinafores, looking solemnly at the Franklin, and at the other by Jack Aubrey, who was returning from her in the splendour of a post-captain, accompanied by Martin and rowed with great exactness by his bargeman.
"There, sir," said Reed at Stephen's side, "that is what I meant by splendid sight."
Stephen followed his gaze beyond the captain's boat to the Franklin. She had cast off her tow, and she was sailing along abreast of the surprise, making a creditable 5 knots under her courses, with a great triangular lateen drum taut on her mizzen gleaming in the sun.
"Very fine indeed," he said.
"She reminds me of the old Victory," observed Reed after a moment.
"Surely to God the Victory has not been sunk or sold out of the service?" asked Stephen, quite startled. "I knew she was old, but thought her immortal, the great ark of the world.
No, sir, no, said Reed patiently. We saw her in the chops of the channel not 2 days out. What I mean is in ancient times, in the last age, before the war even, she used to have a mizzen like that. We have a picture of her at home. My father was her second lieutenant at Toulon, you know. But come, sir, you'll have to shift your coat or go below. The captain will be aboard any minute now.
Perhaps I should disappear, said Stephen, passing a hand over his unshaven chin.
The surprise, having checked her way, received her captain with all the ceremony she could manage in her present state. The boatswain's mates piped the side. Tom Pullings, acting as first lieutenant, Mr. Granger, the second, Mr. Adams, the clerk and de facto purser, and both midshipmen, all in formal clothes, took off their hats, and the captain touched his own to the quarterdeck. Then with a nod to Pullings he went below, where Killick, who had been watching his progress from the moment he left the Franklin, had a pot of coffee ready. Attracted by the smell, Stephen walked in, holding a sharpened razor in his hand. But perceiving that Jack and Pullings meant to talk about matters to do with the ship, he drank only 2 cups and withdrew to the fore cabin in which he usually had his being. Jack called after him,
"As soon as Martin has changed his clothes, he will be on deck, you know."
And at the same time, Killick, whose never very amiable character had been soured still further by having to look after both captain and doctor for years and years, burst in at the forward door with Stephen's good coat over his arm. In a shrill, complaining voice, he cried,
"What, aren't you even shaved yet? God love us, what a disgrace it will bring to the ship!"
"Now, Tom," said Jack Aubrey, "I will tell you very briefly how things are in the Franklin. Granger and Bulkley and the others have done most uncommonly well, and we can send up topmasts tomorrow. I have been considering the prize crew, and although we cannot spare many, I think we shall manage. She has 21 hands left fit to serve, and together with what the doctor can patch up, and 3 of the English ransomers, and a carpenter they took out of a hull whaler to replace their own, she should be adequately manned without weakening the surprise too much. I mean, they should be able to fight at least one side, not merely carry her into port. Most of the Franklins understood some English, so I told them the usual things. Those that saw fit to volunteer should berth with our own people on the lower deck, have full rations, grog and tobacco, and be paid off in South America according to their rating, while those that did not should be kept in the forehold on 2/3 rations, no grog and no tobacco, and be carried back to England. One of the ransomers, a boy, spoke French as brisk as the doctor, and what they did not understand from me they understood from him. I left them to think it over, and there is not much doubt about the result. When we have rearmed her with our carronades, she will make an admirable consort. You shall have command of her, and I will promote Veedle here. We can certainly find you 3 men capable of standing a watch. Mr. Smith, for one, and he will stiffen their gunnery. And even if we were not so well supplied, 2 of the ransomers were mates of their ship, the one a fur trader on the Nootka Run, the other a whaler. Have you any observations, Captain Pullings?"
"Well, sir," said Pullings, returning his smile, but with a certain constraint.
"I take it very kindly that you should give me the command, of course. As for Veedle, he is a prime seaman, of course, there is no doubt of that. But he is the leader of the Nipperdollings, and the Nipperdollings and the Sethians have been at odds ever since the love feast at the Methody Chapel in Botany Bay. And as you know very well, sir, some of the most respected hands on board are Sethians, or their close friends. And to have a Nipperdolling set over them—"
"Hell and death, Tom," said Jack. "You are quite right. It had slipped my mind."
It should not have slipped his mind. For although Shelmerston was well known for bold, enterprising, expert seamen, Veedle himself had armed a ship and cruised upon the Barbary corsairs themselves with remarkable success, it was even better known for its bewildering variety of religious sects, some, like the Sethians, with origins hazy in the remote past, some, like the Nipperdollings, quite recent, but a little apt to be quarrelsome by land if a point of doctrine were raised, and at the love feast in Botany Bay, a disagreement on the filioque clause had ended in many a black eye, many a bloody nose, and broken head. Jack repressed some reflections on seamen and theology, blue light officers and tracts, and said,
"Very well, I shall rearrange the prize crew. Peace at all costs. You shall have the Sethians, and I shall bring back what Nipperdollings there may be in the Franklin. By the way, what is a Nipperdolling?"
Pullings looked perfectly blank and slowly shook his head.
"Well, never mind. The doctor will know. Or even better, Martin. I hear his voice on deck. They will start tolling the bell directly."